Hi, I'm Heather, and I'm an alcoholic. I think we're having fun now. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee and everyone who put this together, and thank you so much for having me. I'd like to say that I have been just happy to be here, but I am not a liar, so what I will say is I have been thinking about being here. A little nervous, but that's okay. So, my sobriety date is 12/4/88. Around midnight tonight, I will have 34 years. So I was drunk tonight 34 years ago. It's true. And my sponsor is Marilyn H. She lives in Eugene. My home group is at the Little Yellow House in Seaside. It is at 5:30. It is a beginner's meeting that I attend. And I hold a couple service positions. So I don't actually consider myself a speaker, but I will say that this event, I had my first ever speaker nightmare 2 nights ago. I could go into the details of my nightmare because it was one of those that was really vivid, but because this is a solution-based program, I'm just going to tell you there's a post-it note on my hotel room door that says, Heather, wear pants. Killing it already. So, you know, I'm not really sure when I became this way, but I'm pretty sure it was when I was born. When I was a little kid, one of my very first memories where I can say, huh, something was up there. I don't remember how old I was, but I had a little friend down the street, and I let her write on my tongue with marker. And this upset me quite a bit. And so I went home, wah, to my mom. I feel it probably sound a little better than that piggy noise, but I went home to my mom and I said, so-and-so down the street, she wrote on my tongue with marker. And I was very sad about this. So my mom looked at me, because she's a practical woman, and she said, Heather, didn't you have to stick out your tongue? So you can see already, I'm having a problem with accountability. I really, really want approval, and I'm a bit of a victim. So this is a good start for me. The next memory that I have where I can remember this is something like this. I think I'm in third grade now, and there was a spelling bee at the school, and I competed in the spelling bee, and the first day, I competed with my class, and I won my class. And then it went up to sixth grade, and by the end of the day, it was very sure that I was going to be in the finals the next day at the spelling bee. And I'm Generation X, not to give away my age if the hair doesn't, and my mom worked. And so she wasn't able to be there the next day. So I went and I did the spelling bee. And I came in second place, which is really, really good for a third grader. But when I got home, and my mom got home from work, she said, Heather, how'd it go? And I said, I won. I could not bear to tell her that I came in second place. I already knew somehow that anything I did, I needed to make it just a little bit better, right? I just needed to make it a little bit better. So already, you know, I'm just uncomfortable in my skin. And the next one, so I lived in a neighborhood in Seattle. I grew up in Seattle and in Queen Anne. And I had a gang of girlfriends because I was an only child and all of our parents worked. And I always had a scheme that I was going to, you know, have my gang of girlfriends do. And I was obsessed with the Guinness Book of World Records. I was going to be in the Guinness Book of World Records, so I'm competitive, I don't have accountability, and I'm a little bit of a liar. And my first effort to get in the Guinness Book of World Records was pogo sticking. So every day when I came home from school, I had a pogo stick, and I would bounce on the pogo stick until my mom called me in for dinner. I didn't know you had to have a person there from the Guinness Book of World Records, but I just can remember getting called in and being like, oh, Mom, I'm never gonna be in it. You just keep ruining my life. And so I gave up on the pogo stick. And then I decided that we would have a rubber band chain war with a street down the, just this next block, right? Just this next block of these other girls, and we were gonna beat them. And I had made a connection with a boy, I know, surprising, who had a paper route. So, you know, I had a hookup, and I was gonna win. And so I was just a really, really, you know what they say about, I wasn't drinking as a child, but I sure could have used one. And that was really me. I was just uncomfortable in my own skin. No one told me. My parents never told me I wasn't good enough. I just knew it already. It was just an innate sense that something was wrong and I was different. The best thing that I've ever heard that described exactly how I felt when I was a child was from a speaker who, I can't remember the name of the speaker, so I can't credit him. So if you know him, you'll let me know afterwards. And what he said was, you had to treat me special so I would feel normal. You had to treat me special so I would feel normal. And that is 100% how I felt. So fast forward a little bit, and I am finally old enough to drink. So I was 14. 14. I tested to get into a school that was for smart kids. This proves that I had some brain cells at one point. And in Seattle, all the kids drink at this place called Golden Gardens. It's really fun there. And so I started going to Golden Gardens right away. And it was a lot of fun. And I can remember the very first time that I drank. I can remember being sick the very first time. I drank till I was sick, and I knew I was going to do it again. I knew that I was having fun. And pretty soon, it wasn't enough. I kind of looked around me, and this is at 14. Nobody's drinking like me. Nobody's pre-gaming. Nobody is making sure that they spend a good hour at the 7-Eleven before you get to Golden Gardens because you had to ask adults to go in and buy you booze, you know? And I was making sure all of this got done. So I I decided that I needed something more. And I kind of moved from the kids that were at the high school, and now there's this nightclub that back then that teenagers went to in Seattle. It was called Scoochies. And the good kids, they went inside Scoochies, and there was like roller skating and stuff. And then the kids that had issues, they hung outside of Scoochies. I did go into Scoochies one time. It was lovely in there. it was lovely. On my 15th birthday, I decided to celebrate, drop acid for the first time. And I did. And I can remember, because I was outside Scoochies, and mind you, my stepdad was a police officer. And he was coming to pick me up at Scoochies, and I'm sitting in the car, and I'm looking at him, and I'm like, he knows I'm high. And every time he said my name, he'd go, you know, Heather. And then I would hear it like this, Heather, 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 Heather. Just flying behind the car. And his face was moving, and I'm like, oh my God, he knows I'm high, I'm dead, I'm dead, I'm dead. And he didn't know, and I made it home. And, you know, pretty soon, here's what happened. I needed oblivion. And what the kids were doing at Scoochies and stuff, it just wasn't, it wasn't quite enough for me. I do remember one particular evening that was perfect. It was up in Broadway in Seattle, and the kids up on Broadway, we hung outside a 7-Eleven, and we just were cooler than everybody, and that's all we did all that whole night, is just be cooler than anybody else. Lots of kids dressed in goth and that kind of thing. And I had gone to 7-Eleven and asked an adult to go inside, and I got a 40-ouncer. And I drank that 40-ouncer, and I didn't get sick, and I had a great time. I couldn't get more that night, just so you know. I couldn't get more, but I drank it, I had a great time, I didn't pee my pants, I didn't vomit, I didn't take off any of my clothing. And I remember thinking to myself, that's it. That's the magic amount of alcohol for this 15-year-old. It's 40 ounces, apparently. I can fit in with everybody else, I'm passing for normal. And I never drank 40 ounces again. Always more, always more. So, things at home at that point, they're not great. You know, they're not great with my stepdad and my mom. And I'm a lot of work. I'm a lot of work. I'm starting to get kicked out of high schools. I got kicked out of that high school. I got tested into. I got kicked out of Garfield, I got kicked out of Roosevelt, I got kicked out of Franklin, I got kicked out of Bellevue Eastside Catholic, I got kicked out of John Marshall Alternative School. So I'm really starting to be labeled as a difficult kid, okay? And I decide to run away. I decide to run away. And at this point, it wasn't a really great decision, running away, but I was definitely had decided to run away. And I introduced myself to the underbelly of Seattle. And how it happened is when I first started as a runaway, I was couch surfing, okay? I was couch surfing. And I was couch surfing at normal places, friends' houses, and that kind of thing. And pretty soon I ran out of places to couch surf. And now I'm not couch surfing anymore, and I'm faced with the decision of heading home. And so in downtown Seattle, I go to the number 2 bus stop, and I sit down at the number 2 bus stop, and I'm waiting to go home, and I'm in a vulnerable place. And of course, somebody noticed. A man comes up to me, and he says, "Would you like to do some powdered alcohol?" Those were not his exact words. And I said, you know what? I think I would. I think I would like to do that. I thought that was a better idea than going home. So I then I'm introduced into the underbelly of Seattle because I'm not going home. And at this point, I am a 15-year-old runaway that has a serious alcohol and drug problem. And on the streets of Seattle, that's a commodity. You know what that is? That's a commodity. And I am, at this point, for singleness of purpose, I'm going to call it spirits. And I liked my spirits in a hypodermic needle. And I was doing that every single day. Just giving away little pieces of my soul every single day. And I'm starting to feel pretty broken at this point. I'm starting to feel pretty broken. However, I'm one of the lucky ones. My particular kind of powdered alcohol rhymes with Seth. And when you're doing Seth, and I know how that sounds, it makes you a little bit paranoid. But I was one of the lucky kids. I had people looking for me. But when you're doing Seth, and you tell your friends that somebody is looking for you, they don't believe you. Nobody believed me. I'd say, somebody is following me. And they'd say, I'm sure somebody is following you, Heather. I'm sure somebody is. Somebody's following us, too. But I really did have somebody following me. And as you can imagine, my parents are pretty alarmed, because I'm still a 15-year-old girl, and I'm missing. And I've been missing for quite a while now. And they hired private detectives to find me. And I was just minding my own business one day, not doing anything good. And someone said, hey, are you Heather? And I answered yes to this day. I don't know why I answered yes. I could come up with any name, but I said, yes, I'm Heather. And two private detectives took me to the ground. I was taken to my aunt's house. I'm a tall person. My uncles are probably between 6'6 and 6'8, and I've got three of them. So they take me to my aunt's house, and they are watching me all night, and my uncles are at every door, so I can't leave. And back in the 80s, in the back of Sunset Magazine, they advertised, if you had a troubled kid, there was this thing called survival camp, and if you had just enough money, you could take your troubled kid from the ad in Sunset Magazine, where you would find it, and you could take and you could send her to survival camp. And this is what happened to me. I actually, outside of the strip search going in, didn't mind survival camp that much. It was a 21-day program. But it's the first time that I am about to find out that I can't quit. I can't quit the disease, and I can't quit getting loaded on my own. And one of the reasons I find out is I get there, and I'm in the program, and they do this thing. So you do a solo, and for 21 days, you get a buck knife. You have just not very much, like a little bit of oatmeal. They basically starve you, so you can pay to have your child starved. But at the end, it's a very dramatic thing. They have this trail run, and you run out and you go to meet your parents. And I can remember I had had a clear enough head at that point that I wanted to be different. I wanted to be a better daughter. I wanted to stop all the stuff I'm doing. I wanted to stop getting arrested. I'm getting popped in and out of juvie. I'm actually on a thing now called SOAP, and that is stay out of all areas of prostitution. So at 15 years old, I was a known prostitute enough that if I was seen on certain streets of Seattle, I could be arrested on sight. Right? I could be arrested on sight. So I'm thinking, okay, this is good. I'll come out of this trail run, and I'm going to be a good daughter. I'm going to do this. And I meant every single word of it. Met my parents, and we get back to Seattle. It was in Bliss, Idaho. And I made it 2 days. 2 days. And I was so uncomfortable. I can only describe it as like a drive to self-destruct. I just needed that oblivion. And so now I'm back out, and I'm doing the same things, and I'm getting arrested. And it feels more like me now, right? I'm settling into the lifestyle. It doesn't feel like something, like a phase I'm doing or anything like this. Like, I've got my people, I had what I did, and I had it down pat. So, thank goodness those parents never gave up on me, because once again, at some point, I'm telling people are following me, and again, I am And this time it's my uncle. My uncle is driving down a street in Seattle, and I'm in a car, a stranger's car, and my uncle looks over. We get to a stoplight, he gets out, and he physically removes me from this person's car, and he puts me in his car. He had a brand new Jeep Cherokee back then, and I think it was 86. You remember those, like the boxy ones? They were really beautiful. But by this time, I am a wild animal, basically. I am a wild animal, and I am kicking and screaming, and he not let me forget this. And I took my foot and I smashed it through the entire windshield of, and all the glass came crashing down. And he said to me, my cousins were really important, he said, you know, I don't think I can let you be around my kids anymore. I remember thinking back then, that got through. That was like another little thing. Like, oh, I'm the kind of person that can't be around his kids. A really important part of my story is coming next. I think it really saved my life. My parents moved me down to San Diego because really the problem was not me, it's the people I was hanging out with. They were just not good people. They were not a good influence, and this was the problem. So if I just got to a different area, it would be fine. So I'm in La Jolla, San Diego now, and I gotta tell you guys, it's beautiful there. There was a beach. I got a job that was a block from the beach. I could run from the beach to the restaurant I worked in, soaking wet, putting on, it was Tsukasa restaurant, if any of you know Southern California. Anyways, I could put on my hostess dress and arrive. And I was not, at this point, using those kind of spirits, right? And for all intents and purposes, my mindset was that I am now doing everybody a favor because I'm only drinking. I'm only drinking. And I think I've arrived. I mean, I really do. I think this is, I mean, basically, I'm normal. I only drink, get drunk, piss myself, vomit on myself, lose my car, drive drunk, wake up somewhere I don't know like 5 times a week. That's it. That's it. That's all that was happening. And I'm still not old enough to drink, right? So it's really close to the Mexican border. I'm 16 now. I mean, we're talking from the time that I decided that I would drop acid at Scoochie's, I'm 16. It was just like a roller coaster downhill, just fast and furious. So I have a Carmagia, and now I just can't really be without alcohol. So I've got this old Volkswagen Carmagia, and it's got these floorboards that come up, and I would get in my car alone at 16, and I would drive down to Tijuana, and I'd buy tequila for the week, and I would smuggle it across the border. About twice a week is what I needed to do to make sure that I had enough alcohol that I wasn't a drug addict anymore. Such good thinking. Such good thinking. But what happened in this time period of my life is what I realized, not then, but now, was that my relationship with alcohol was really broken too. I moved back up to Seattle after that, and within a week of moving back up to Seattle, I'm back doing the spirits again. It takes me about a week. This time, it's even worse. This time I've kind of had a break, and I've had I've had enough normal and taken a break from that lifestyle enough that I'm feeling like that trading of pieces of my soul is just it's just getting worse. But I've really decided that there's nothing I can do about it. There's absolutely nothing I can do about it. This is how I die. This is how I die. And I am, again, have somebody say, is your name Heather? I'm 17 now, 17 years old. I say yes, and they take me and they put me in a car. This time, though, I've now been to survival camp. San Diego was like the best trip, right? From being followed and taken down, the beach was the best place I ever went. This time it was to a psych ward in Beaverton. You could hold a kid in a psych ward in Beaverton back then without their consent. You couldn't get me into treatment. You couldn't have gotten me into treatment. And so I landed in this hallway, and they would not let me use the phone. And, you know, like, in that moment, I'm a little Karen. And if your name is Karen, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I wanted to speak to the manager. I wanted to speak to the manager because I don't belong here. These people are crazy. And I'm starting to think, I'm only an addict and alcoholic. I don't belong here. Can I please speak to someone? I need to use the phone. And after the blackout period, I got to use the phone, and I called my mom and I said, hey, I really need out of here. I really need out of here, Mom. I don't belong here. I don't fit in here. And then she made me an offer that I could not refuse. How about you go to treatment? If you had asked me the week before if I was going to go to treatment, the answer would have been no. Now I'm in a lockdown in a psych ward with my parents in complete control of my future. And I think to myself, okay, treatment doesn't sound terrible. It's got to be better than this. And I went to a Cascade Oaks treatment center at 17 years old. And it was a 28-day program. It was for minors. I graduated early because I got all my homework done. I said everything they wanted me to say. Remember, I'd graduated from that. I was in the gifted program thing, so I'm still a little bit smart back then. And I said everything they want to hear, and I graduate early. And I don't know if you call it a relapse, since it wasn't my idea to go to treatment. But let's just say I didn't make it the week. I didn't make it a week. Believe it or not, we're getting to the end of my drinking. And once I relapsed after treatment, once I went back to doing what I wanted to do in the first place, my parents washed their hands of me. I moved into that stage where our loved ones no, they can't help us. You know, I'm not being followed anymore. I have a little apartment on Capitol Hill, and there's these three streets, Bellevue, Bellevue, and Bellevue, and they all join. And I lived in a one-bedroom apartment there. Now, they call them trap houses now, but that term had not come up back then, and so it was a little bit fancier. It was a shooting gallery, and it was my apartment, but there was probably 30 people in the one-bedroom apartment. I had a couple Seth Cooks there. And I'm sitting there one day, and I'm sure just checking out, and I hear a very distinctive thought. You know, like One of those thoughts, I know that it's not from me, and it's clear as a bell, and it is because I turn 18 years old right after treatment. And this is when my parents have washed their hands of me. And it is, Heather, you're not going to be doing this when you're 19. I think my first thought should have been I would be dead, but it wasn't. And I remember that week thinking to myself, huh, because it kept coming in my mind, you're not going to be doing this when you're 19. Well, that's random. But I feel like there's these places in a disease where windows open, moments of clarity happen, and this was definitely one of those moments of clarity, and although I didn't jump on it right away, it was there. I was starting to think, and plus I was terrible. I was just terrible in that shooting gallery thing because I had been to treatment, so I had the information. So I would sit around and tell them that we had a disease and we were all dying. I was a buzz kill. And remember, I was smart, so I could like spout it out, you know? Spout the whole thing out, and they'd be like, you know what, shut up, Heather. I get it, we're dying, voluntarily. So I'm sitting there and I'm actually pretty hungry one night. I don't think I had slept for like 14 days and I don't know when the last time I ate was. So I was in a really good state of mind. I had done some car prowling and I had a checkbook that wasn't mine. There was no debit cards back then. All this gray hair. There was no debit cards back then, so people still wrote checks. So I called this little restaurant called the Orient Express on Lake Union. It wasn't that far from Capitol Hill. And I put on my best parochial schoolgirl voice. Hi. I use my real name again. Even when I was getting in the cars with strangers, I used my real name. I needed a stage name. I needed a stage name, but I never had one. Hi, this is Heather. And I didn't say I'm an alcoholic. I'm at a party with my parents and their friends, and they're all drinking. But they also want some food. If I brought my dad's check down, would you be willing to take the check and I could bring the food home to them? Well, they say yes, so that's great. So I go down and I get the food and I get home and I'm eating the food and everything's good. And then the next day, I wake up and all I'm doing now, I'm minding my own business, but I was kind of minding my own business like with a curtain, right? Like looking out of it. Just looking to see what's going on in this street. Just one eye watching in case I was being followed. And I see the Orient Express car driving and circling around Bellevue, Bellevue, and Bellevue. Thank God I haven't slept in 14 days. Thank God I wasn't in my right mind, because you know what I thought? They're coming for me. I'm going to prison. They're sending the delivery driver. They send the delivery driver. He's here for me. He is going to arrest me. And I am 18 years old now. And Violent Femmes was my favorite band back then. I know. And I used to, you know, like be like, high as a kite, I just might stop singing and spare you guys. But the song that came to my mind was, this song saved my life. I don't know the rest of the song. But I heard again another voice and it said, this will go down on your permanent record. I had done 72 hours in juvie already, so I knew about incarceration. And I wasn't built for it. So, between that one voice and that thing, there was a payphone on the corner. I hustled down there and I called my parents. And I said two words, I'm done. And I have been clean and sober ever since. So my story is really one about recovery most of my life. I'm a 52-year-old woman who has been in these rooms since a week after her 18th birthday. And so all I really have to share with you is recovery. That has been my entire life. When I got down, then my parents sent me back down to San Diego, and that was great. And my big plan was to pretend like nothing happened. Everything was fine. And before I got down there, my mom and dad sat me down and they said, "You never have to tell anybody about what you've done, ever. Don't ever tell anybody." And you know what? I thought, that's a good idea. I better never tell anybody about it. I better never tell anybody. I haven't really talked about this much before this, but I'm in a lot of pain, a lot of emotional pain. I am broken. I can hardly lift my head up and look people in the eye. Shame is my constant companion. I never, in my wildest dreams, think I'm going to be okay again. You know, like that stuff that I did, those were some deep wounds. And I was really young. And there were grown men helping me do that. You know, it was a bad scene. But I was going to pretend like nothing happened and everything was going to be fine and I was just going to go be normal. And I needed money. And so my friend Stacy, who did not know, she worked with me at that Mexican restaurant. She had no idea she was getting sent somebody that was coming off of Seth. She said, "Hey, on Monday nights, I don't really want to do it anymore, but I have a really good babysitting job." So the minimum wage at the time is $3.25 an hour. It's $15, and you just have to babysit these really nice kids for an hour. Oh, I think I can do that, okay. Everybody wants me watching their kids, but you know, I was gonna pretend it didn't happen. It was babysitting for a women's AA meeting. God was after me. He was following me. So I went and I watched the kids and I made my $15. And the woman's house that it was, her name is Christine. And you know, Zan really reminds me of Christine. It's one thing I love about her. And Christine came to me and she said, "Maybe next week you want to come and be in the meeting." And I thought, okay, I mean, if they really want me to, I can come be in the meeting. You know, like, because when you guys told me to, like, keep coming back and that you were glad I was there, I didn't know you were saying it to everybody. You made me feel special, which was kind of normal. So I went into the women's AA meeting. What I will tell you is that woman, Christine, is still in my life today. She was my sponsor for 30 solid years. And she took me through my first round of steps. Now, when I got into the program, I did not have any desire to work the steps for the first 4 months. I just cried and cried and cried and shook, sometimes shared too long. I was just basically a mess, but I really didn't think that anything here would help me because I thought I was worse than all of you. And so I just didn't think this was gonna work. But I'm sure I was just boohooing at some meeting, the women's meeting, and a woman came up to me afterwards, and the shame is heavy. The pain is a cloak. It is with me all the time. And she said, "You know that shame you feel?" And I said, "Yeah." "That goes away around step 4 and 5. Ha! Finally, somebody said something. I would not work the steps to stay sober. But to feel, this one's a menace. But to feel, that's a menace. But to feel different, the idea that that might change had never occurred to me. And so, of course, I wanted to do my fourth step right away, but Christine made me start at my first step. So, my first step They say that the first step is the only one that you can do perfectly. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our life had become unmanageable. She was very wise, and she kept me in that first step until I identified as an alcoholic. No matter what I just told you in my story, and I know you invited me here because you wanted me to be honest, and I can't tell my story without telling you about the spirits and Seth. She had me go through and identify myself as an alcoholic, and I understood when I got out of that first step that alcohol as a standalone was my problem, and it was a problem for me. And what I can tell you is, in tomorrow, I guess we're still 33 years, let's not push our luck. In 33 years, I have never ran into Seth, but I have been offered alcohol hundreds of times. And if I hadn't known for sure that I was an alcoholic, I don't know if I'd be sober today. I think she really saved my life with that. And on step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I want to share with you that my very, very favorite definition of insanity, and it, or sanity. Sanity is the ability to see the truth. Insanity is the inability to see the truth. And God, is that not true with the disease? When I was in it, I could not see the truth of what I was doing. And that was just complete insanity. And this program made it so I could start seeing the truth. My very first higher power was simply the idea that I could heal. That was it. I didn't have a God concept. But I saw you guys, and I thought, you know what, maybe I can heal. Maybe I can heal. And on the third step, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. My very first decision I made, again, because I was newly sober, I didn't really have a God concept. I wasn't so sure about that, and this is all about willingness. But I really saw that I could do one of two things. I could attach to my pain, or I could attach to the idea of healing in this program. I knew I was going to attach to something, you know? I knew I was going to attach to something, and if I attached to the pain, I don't know if I would still be here. I had to believe, I had to have hope that that was going to get better, and that was kind of my first third step. And I was pretty excited to get to the fourth step, because I had been made this, you know, this is why I wanted to start the steps. My first fourth step was about as good as an 18-year-old girl could do. I wouldn't say it was perfect. But you know what? It was honest. It was everything I could put into it at the time. And my higher power honored the effort. And my higher power honored the effort. And when 4 and 5 came, I am happy to report that I was told the truth. The shame left and has not returned. It left and it has not returned, and I have to say that freedom is the biggest gift in my entire life. I hold my head up now. Anything that happened does not have any power over me, and that is through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. 6 and 7. My first 6 and 7 weren't perfect, but you know what? I'm gonna tell you my favorite thing about 6 and 7. I'm really excited to read this to you, okay? It's the only thing I'm going to read. It's out of the 12 and 12, page 75, and it says, in every AA story, pain has been the price of admission into a new life. But the admission price purchased more than we expected. It led us to a measure of humility, which we soon discovered to be a healer of pain. We begin to fear pain less and desire humility more than ever. And for some reason, in this last round of steps, we soon discovered that humility was a healer of pain. And I just had this perception shift. And I started to look at my defects as unhealed areas. And they started to be a lot less cool to me. Right? And then when I read the literature, sometimes when the word humility would come up, I would use healed, healer, heal, and read the sentence again. And I started to understand the 6 and 7 a lot more. Am I saying that, you know, when I'm afraid, my ego gets bumped, or I'm prideful that I'm not going to defect out one day? No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that knowing that the areas that I have a lack of humility are areas that I have a lack of healing really, really helps motivate me to want to be better and to want to go after those areas, because I liked some of my character defects before, and they're not as cool anymore since I read that. 8 and 9. Here's what I will say about 8 and 9. Don't do them before you're ready. Don't do them out of order. It is the first thing, I think, that when you first get sober, you see that amends thing. And for me, it's like, you know what? I really want to talk to that boy from a year ago, because I was a kid. I'll call him and make amends. What happens if you call and make amends before you're ready and you don't do it in order is I don't understand my actual responsibility. I don't understand my patterns. I don't understand my defects, and I certainly don't understand what it's like to be loved by me. And I cannot stand in responsibility. So waiting until that happens is a really good idea, and my sponsor really guided me in that with the amends. Just do it in order. You're not ready until you're ready. 10 and 11, those are really good steps, the inventory steps, daily inventory, daily meditation. So here's the thing, because I'm an alcoholic, I don't always do exactly what I should do. And what I've noticed is when I have a really good discipline with 10 and 11, my life goes better. But sometimes I don't do them anyways. I don't know what that's about. Most of the time I'll do them, but then I'll go a week or two where all of a sudden I've been too busy and this and that happened and I haven't done 10 and 11. I start to get a little bit crazy. And that's just telling you the truth. That is just telling you the truth. I don't do that perfectly. I do it most of the time. And the people that do it every day, like, my hat's off to you, that you can do something that is good for you every single day and not drop off like I do. But I do, I drop off. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, carried the message to other alcoholics and practiced these principles in all our affairs. Obsession. The obsession to drink. The obsession about anything. What I have found about service is that when obsession is my poison, service is the antidote. It is the only way I have ever found to shut my own head up. And it doesn't seem to matter about what. And I don't know about you guys, but when I'm obsessing on something, it feels like somebody put a clamp in my mind. And no matter what I do, I go back to that thing, and I loop back at that thing, and I loop back at that thing. And what I have found is the antidote for that is service. As soon as I'm doing something for somebody else and getting out of my head, whether that be in the rooms or that be picking up garbage on the street, because, you know, service is service, I'm suddenly out of my head. And practicing these principles in all our affairs, I like really love simple, practical things. I like practical applications of things, things that are easy for me to remember and easy for me to do. And so when I'm making a big decision, maybe it's not a big decision, maybe I just think it's a big decision, I run through the principles behind each step. And I take whatever that is, and I go and ask myself, is it honest? You know, am I being hopeful? Allowing others to hope? Am I practicing faith? Am I being a coward, or is it courageous, you know? Because to have courage, you have to be a little afraid sometimes. Am I practicing integrity? Am I being willing? Am I being willing to go to any lengths? Is humility there? Or is my ego there? Which one's driving? Love, discipline, perseverance, spirituality, service. I can't say that if it doesn't go perfectly on this, that I don't do it. Sometimes I just want to do stuff and I do it anyways. That's the truth. Sometimes I do it anyways, but I know I'm making a mistake because I ran it through this. And most of the time, I'll go by what that says. So, I have heard that a relapse is like doing the steps backwards. At about 25 years sober, although I never did take a drink, I had that happen. I had it happen. My son died of a heroin overdose. And it was like someone turned off the lights. It was like someone turned off the lights. And the first thing that happened was that I didn't want to go to meetings anymore. You know, I honestly didn't want to talk to my sponsees at the time because I was fragile. And I wasn't used to feeling fragile, and my ego almost wouldn't allow it. Like, I didn't even know how to be vulnerable. I did 10 and 11, even less. 8 and 9, people owed me apologies. People owed me apologies. 6 and 7, no humility. I was so attached to my own pain from the death of my son that I couldn't right-size anything. And I was defecting out all the time, just defecting out all the time. 4 and 5, when I read the literature, I thought you should really read this because it would really help you. I was taking other people's inventories. Always a good sign I'm off track when I read the literature and think somebody else needs to read it, not me. I couldn't feel God. I know that God, for me, is not a feeling. It's a, you know, God's a fact for me. But having that shut down and feeling so dark was something I wasn't accustomed to. And all of this made my life unmanageable. It was unmanageable. On my 25th sobriety birthday was his service. And at this point, the only thing left in the relapse is actually to pick up, which I haven't done yet. And I made a decision. And I made a decision, and I ran back to you guys. I hightailed it back to you. I had been sane enough portions in my sobriety. I had had the joy of recovery. I had had the peace of mind, the comfort in my skin, to know that this wasn't okay, that I was not okay. And I ran back to you guys, honestly, as fast as I could. And I did 90 in 90. I started the steps again. And if anybody is in a place where they have a chunk of sobriety, but you're just not feeling it, come back for your second miracle. Come back and get your second miracle. Get your third miracle, get your fourth, because every single time I've worked these steps, a miracle has happened. A miracle has happened every single time I've worked these steps. And this was no exception. If you do this, expect a miracle. And it's not because I'm special. I didn't out meeting anybody. I don't have the big book memorized better than anybody. I didn't do anything better than anybody. The truth is that this program works. These steps work. And every time I've done them, I have been able to expect a miracle. I have to say that every single time a healing or something, an event, becomes complete for me, it's a full circle thing, right? It's when my experience can benefit others. At that point, I know that the program and the sunlight of the spirit is working. I was taking a plane ride, and I have to say that with the death of my son, I really, really did. It was painful, and it was mine. And I really wasn't ready before this to talk about it and move on from it. I don't know if I wanted to move on from it. But I'm on a plane ride, and I was putting my headphones in because I'm not super friendly on planes. And a little lady sits next to me, and she's swinging her little feet because she was a very small person. I don't know why I remember that. I know I shouldn't remember that, but I think because I'm tall and her feet weren't reaching the ground, I noticed that right away. And she wanted to talk. She started talking to me. And so, because I am polite and a little bit of a people pleaser, I put my headphones away and I started talking with her. And she was flying back to Portland because her son was dying. And he was probably going to be passed by the time the week is over. And I can remember that moment when I realized that this is what we were going to be talking about. I can remember with my higher power just thinking, okay, God, you want this? You want this too. This is for others. My son's death, we're gonna do this. Like, you want this. And I had a willingness at that point that was not for me. And her and I had a conversation about death that if you've lost somebody really close to you, you may be able to speak about death in a way that others can't, because people don't want to talk about it because you don't want to say anything wrong, right? Who wants to talk about to someone about their son dying? Because then you might offend them, or you might say the wrong thing, you know, all of that stuff. But we sat and we talked about it, and she cried and I cried and she thanked me. And what I can say is that I would take my son back in a second over growth. However, I am a better person. I am a more compassionate person. I am a more vulnerable person. I am a less judgmental person. Because anything that I surrender, my higher power will make beauty out of. He will make growth, and he will make beauty out of anything. Any pain I give comes back to me in something that can help another person. And I will be honest, I would take my son back in an instant and ungrow, but I needed some of that growth. I needed some humility, and I needed to learn how to be vulnerable and more compassionate. And I'm really grateful that this program gives a place for that to happen, you know? Lately, this year, I've been working on being kinder in my own mind to myself. That's like the next frontier. I'm really hard on myself, and what I found is that I'll even use this program sometimes to fall short, you know, judge myself based on the program. Oh, I shouldn't be angry because, you know, this. I shouldn't do this because just so much self-talk, and my sponsor called me out on it, and I've really, really been working on it, and what I'm finding is that the kinder I am to myself and my own thoughts, the kinder I can show up for others. And I didn't really even really realize that it translated so much, you know? I didn't know how much it translated. It's still a work in progress, absolutely a work in progress, but it's getting better. And that's kind of the next frontier for me, is not judging things good and bad, not doing the black and white thinking, not being hard on myself, and just accepting and observing whatever is happening right now. So if I have an emotion that I would have labeled negative before, now I just, oh, I see. So when this happens, this is how I respond. And just take a moment and observe it without judgment. And it passes a lot more quickly that way. So I'm kind of happy about that. And really, you know, you guys, that's what I have. You know, that's my experience with the steps. That's my experience with healing. And, you know, that's what it was like for me when I was using. So I really appreciate you guys having me. Thank you.